can you talk about a little bit about approaching the text as an actor, as an adapter as well? What is it? What is it about Shakespeare's language that is wonderful and or an enormous pain?
Oh, that's such an interesting question.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever it is, wherever you are. Thanks for subscribing, streaming, or downloading and listening to us on your computer or tablet or phone. I'm Austin Titchener, one third of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, and you're listening to this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast, number 531, Thinking Shakespeare's Text. Two weeks ago, we talked with Ben Crystal about speaking Shakespeare's text in its original Elizabethan pronunciation, so it seemed like the perfect time to talk about thinking Shakespeare's text. Podcast listeners will remember my conversations with Scott Parkinson, one of the truly great American interpreters of Shakespeare, and certainly the only one I know personally who will talk to me. My wife Dee and I have known Scott since he played Caliban in The Tempest in New Hampshire when he was only an amazingly talented teenager. And I talked to him on the podcast about 4 or 5 years ago during his spectacular run as Hamlet at the Writers' Theater. And again, last fall of 2016 when he played Cassius in the Writers' Theater production of Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, a production that he also adapted and co-directed. When we spoke last fall, we ended up talking a lot longer than we planned because I wanted to find out how Scott manages to make his delivery of Shakespeare so unique and specific, but also so contemporary sounding and natural. It seemed to me that in addition to speaking Shakespeare's text, Scott has the ability to think Shakespeare's text. And as we talked, it seems like I had nailed it pretty much on the head. We started by talking about the production of Julius Caesar we had just seen Scott in. It was a fantastic cast, and I'm not just blowing smoke because we're old friends and you're doing this podcast for me, but you have a way of delivering the Shakespearean text that feels up-to-the-minute modern and contemporary. You breathe in a contemporary rhythm. You speak in a contemporary rhythm without sacrificing somehow the rhythm of Shakespeare's language. And are you able to articulate how and why you do that? Because I'm taking notes because I want to steal as much as I can.
Yeah, I mean, that's always been my goal. I think since, you know, I remember when I saw Branagh's Henry V when I was, I think it came out that summer that we did.
That we all worked together.
Yeah. I think it was shortly thereafter anyway that came out. It was somewhere there, and I remember that. It just blew my mind because everybody in that sounded just like people. Nothing about it sounded like Shakespeare or spoken in this very, you know, decorated way at all or declaimed way at all. I really felt like there was so much at stake at every moment, and it all felt very contemporary in the way people were talking. I mean, they all had British accents, so there's that, but they still, right. It still really felt like people just talking. So I've always been, I think that was a really formative thing for me just in terms of how I wanted to approach the verse. And I mean, I think that I've worked with people who speak it a little bit more lyrically than I do, and I've seen them give terrific performances and very moving, but for whatever reason it's always just lived in a more sort of a less lyrical place for me. The thing that I think has helped me in terms of clarity is when I discovered the idea of phrasing with the verse line, which I don't know how familiar you are with that, but there's a wonderful book by Barry Edelstein called Thinking Shakespeare. And I was first introduced to this technique by a wonderful coach. Rob Clare is his name. And, you know, what Rob would talk about is that built into the verse on the page, the shape of the verse on the page is actually the way we think and the way that people talk, and that once you understand that and you understand the sort of notion behind it, because a lot of times, of course, the verse at the end of a verse line, the thought isn't done; it's right. Hanging in the air. So the idea is, well, why would you pause there, or why would you have a sort of beat of when the thought isn't over with? And then conversely, in the middle of the line, there's like a period sometimes, and the rule anyway is that you don't stop and you don't pause there, but you keep jumping. You jump to the next thought.
Right.
And of course, when you start to sort of work with that, you realize that we actually do that all the time in life. We frequently stop in the middle of a thought to think about the next thing we're going to say.
Yeah.
Or we finish one thing and jump immediately onto the next thing.
Yeah.
And what I've found anyway, since I've learned this technique, is that probably 8 or 9 times out of 10, when I've applied it to what I'm speaking in Shakespeare, it's like it's eerie. Like, it's like he knew exactly what he was doing in the way that he's put it on the page. And he knew that that is a place where you can actually stop and think about what the next thing is you were going to say.
Right.
And when you do it, it actually makes it 10 times clearer to the audience, to the ear. And partly, I think, because we tend to think in pentameter. We tend to think ahead in pentameter, and we tend to speak in pentameter, which is, of course, what they always tell you when you're in Shakespeare acting class. And I think there's some truth to that, and all that stuff you learn about the heartbeat and the number of beats that it takes to talk or to make a point. I think all of that is true. So when you're listening to the verse in those 10 beats and you're really hearing it in those 10 beats, there's something I think about the way that that hits the ear that is just, it's clearer, I think.
Yeah,
that's been my experience anyway, because frequently that's what people will say when they hear the technique. They'll say, it's so much clearer to me. I understand it so much better now.
Well, and it's a way of, it's kind of training, it's less about training your mouth to speak the words than it is training your brain to think the thoughts.
Uh-huh.
And so it gives some undercurrent to the text in a way that makes the text come alive in a different kind of a way, rather than in the Gilgudian lyrical way of singing the text.
And it's the doses in which you hear certain thoughts and ideas that you hear it within a certain, and then there's a second for you to catch up or whatever.
Right.
And I think I think some people wonder if it adds, like, if it's actually adds more time to an evening of Shakespeare. I actually think it cuts time, because it almost becomes like a musical rhythm that you have to stay in in line with. And if you take too much time at the end of a line, or if you take too much time, I mean, the only place really when you use this technique that you can take time is if there's a period at the end of a verse line. That's where you could actually take a big honking pause if you wanted to.
Right.
Or if Shakespeare has given you a pause and built it into the verse, you could do it there if you wanted to. But other than that, you really can't take a big pause when you're using this technique.
Right.
You have to keep moving on because the beat is there that's been established by his verse.
Well, and it helps the musical phrasing of it to keep it interesting. So it isn't just ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da.
Right.
Because there have been magnificent performances with amazing actors where I've just zoned because the text is just gotten into this place of drone. Droning without as much, without this kind of variety of phrasing that you're talking about.
That's a good way to put it. It is. It's a variety of phrasing, and it's the way that it's not easy to do sometimes. I mean, I think sometimes when people try to do it, it can sound very mechanical, and it can actually sound very inhuman.
Yeah.
But I have found it to be, for whatever reason, very exciting, the way that it opens up possibilities for me.
Yeah.
And did you, this is Dee, I've been sitting here listening. I've just been entranced the whole time. But I'm wondering, did you take this approach when you were directing this production? Is this something that you start with, or is this something that, I mean, I'm assuming it is something that you start with, seeing when the pauses are in the text before you start getting up and speaking
walking it. Walking around.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely use it for myself as an actor anytime I do Shakespeare now. We did do, before we did this, we did a workshop about a week or so before we started rehearsals, where we knew there was going to be a lot of movement in the show, and we were working with a movement guy that we wanted to kind of see what he was going to do. So we had a workshop with him where a couple of hours we worked on movement, and then the last couple of hours we did a verse textual analysis kind of thing. And we did present at that point, I presented the phrasing with the verse line technique and talked about it. And I said, basically, if this works for you, use it. And if it doesn't, don't. We don't want to prescribe any way of speaking the verse on anybody, but this is the technique I use, and this is why I love it, and this is how it works, and how it works for me. And so I just always want, from a directorial point of view, I want the actors to have as many options as possible. I think when I was sitting down looking at the text, looking at other roles other than Cassius, I would look at some of the phrasing with the verse line to see how that might or might not be helpful, and then in individual verse coaching sessions with people, I could talk to them about that. Like, well, what about here? If you use this, if you do decide to use this moment at the end of the verse line as a place for you to shift thought or to think about what the next thing is you're going to say, what does that gain you, or what does it not gain you? Or I just always like there to be more and more options for people and for actors. So,
well, and it seems like it's a way, another tool of being not only faithful to the text or the ideas behind the text, but in a way that you're not a slave to it. Mm-hmm. And I would imagine that would have helped in maybe getting over the hurdle of, oh my God, I can't touch Shakespeare's words. I can't cut them. But you were able to go, nah, screw it. I'm cutting a lot of this play.
I did. I know. And I tried to keep at least a 10 to 12 beat line, but there's a couple of times where I think we have an 8 or a 9 beat line in there, unfortunately, with some of the cutting that I did. But
do you know what? I think he did that as well.
I think
Old
he
Will.
Did too. Yeah. So he was always taking liberties with his own rules.
And it's good to know the rules so you can break them.
Yeah. And some people feel very constrained by this technique. I mean, some people really hate having to phrase with the first line. They just think that, you know, I know when it first kind of came on the scene about 20 years ago, I think it was Peter Hall who introduced it 20 or 25 years ago, there were many actors who were just like, this is terrible, and this just makes me feel like I'm in a straitjacket, and I have to, you know, I always hate to use the word pause at the end of the verse line, of every verse line. It's not really a pause, it's more of a thinking moment at the end of every verse line. And actors who would say, I have to do this? This is ridiculous. And I can understand why people would feel that way. I have found the opposite. I find it to be very liberating, and I find it to actually present me with many more interesting choices than I would have thought.
Well, and I think it's probably because you're not slavish to it in a way that somebody coming to it new is going to go, well, I got to get this right.
No,
and you're using it as, in a way that's more comfortable.
And I occasionally throw it out myself. There are some times where I'm just like, I can't stop in the middle of that thought.
Right.
It just doesn't make any sense for me to stop. I cannot figure out a way to stop in the middle of that thought and make it make any sense to an audience. So sometimes I will throw it away too. It's rare, but I will do that sometimes.
Well, and it was a thing that you did so amazingly in Hamlet. You came out at the very first scene already in a pitch of a depression and sadness over your father's death, and it reminded me when I first saw it, it's like, oh right, there's beautiful text, but he's in enormous emotional pain.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you were actually even crying, and it's like, mm-hmm, oh right, an actor has to bring that to the text as well.
Yeah It's hard. Well, I remember in Hamlet, I used to sit backstage about 10 or 15 minutes before the show started just to get, you know, some actors can just come on stage and turn it on and they're just there, and I envy those actors so much, but I would need to take like 5 to 10 minutes before the show to just sit there and like listen to sad music and like think about all kinds of horrible things.
Pull out nose hairs.
So, to get myself into this place where I felt like I was ready to embody the level of pain and misery that Hamlet is in the beginning of that play. You know, there's also so many different ways that people express pain and misery, and you know, I was actually. We probably talked about this when I did the Hamlet podcast. I was actually surprised in Hamlet the way it ended up coming out of me. I figured it was going to be a much more cerebral pain, that that it would come out in a very different way than it ended up coming out. And that's the thing with Hamlet. You could do it a million times and play it a million different ways, and
right,
his pain could come out in so many different ways.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's why you were like, as soon as you're done with it, you're like, can I go back and do it again? Now I have all these other things I want to do, and you know.
Do you think you'll be going to Cassius or Hamlet ever again?
Oh, God.
Please, God, no.
I don't know. Well, I'm a little long in the tooth for Hamlet, unless we can come up with some sort of concept for that. I would certainly love to do it again. It's interesting. I did a production of it in New York last year where I did not play Hamlet. I played Rosencrantz, but Peter Sarsgaard, wonderful, wonderful, brilliant actor, played Hamlet. And one of the things I loved about Peter's performance is I think he knew that you could play this role in a thousand different ways, and he was like, why not try them all? So, you know, from night to night, you never knew quite what his Hamlet was going to be, and I thought it was spectacular. It was so fun to watch from night to night. You were
what
just
was,
like...
I mean, but what about the ensemble? Was the ensemble like, well, tonight it's, I don't know, see you out there.
Well, I think, you know, obviously you can really only sort of do that in a in a very specific rehearsal process. And we had had a kind of rehearsal process that encouraged a lot of that and a lot of exploration. Austin Pendleton was the director.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and it was just, and it was just a lot of actors who were very much of that kind of mindset of let's try something different every day and every night. And so from day one, it had been kind of established that that was the way this production was going to be. And some people, you know, were less into that than others, certainly. But at some point, I think everybody just kind of gave in and met in the middle somewhere. And it was a fascinating, fascinating experience.
Ratchford, Managing Director of the American Shakespeare Center, and you're listening to the Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast.
Where can you RSC the RSC? In the UK, James Percy, Matt Pearson, and Joe Maudsley continue their 50-city tour of William Shakespeare's long-lost first play Abridged, with performances in Birmingham, Bury St. Edmunds, Colchester, and Lincoln. And next week, they'll perform long-lost Shakes in Leicester, bringing Shakespeare's long-lost first manuscript back to the city in Carr Park, where it was first discovered. As always, the very best way to stay up to date about all of our worldwide performance dates is to sign up for the Reduced Reader, our email newsletter. Go to ReducedShakespeare.com and click on the link to subscribe and check out our touring page for specific box office, venue, and ticket information. And now back to the rest of Dee's and my conversation with Scott Parkinson. We ended up having a little salon in our backyard that afternoon, and we continued talking about the production of Julius Caesar that Scott adapted, co-directed, and played Cassius in. It's fascinating to hear this conversation again because we recorded it before the presidential election last fall of 2016, and since President Trump Finskin has now taken office, there have been several productions of Julius Caesar announced, most notably New York's Public Theater, which will do it as one of their free Shakespeare in the Park productions in the summer of 2017. Scott's Writers Theater production seemed to sort of get the ball rolling, not only for this specific political moment, but also for the brand new Writers Theater building.
There's something so personal about the end of the play, too, about the two men together, yeah. Which I think is kind of great because we start with like this big giant world. Mm-hmm. I was really moved by it because I think to me it was like, oh, this whole election is so crazy, but it really does come down to an individual and that these guys are, because of their choices, have ended here. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was just great. Yeah. I loved it. Yeah.
I'd love to hear that. Yeah. I think that's very much what we were trying to do. We had a lot of discussions about how, I mean, this is true in all of Shakespeare's history plays, how you see these events that happen between people in relationships in small rooms, how they have effects that go so far beyond that.
Yeah.
And you know, Cassius and Brutus, to a certain extent, they break the world. they do this thing.
Which was really completely and perfectly visualized by the set.
Yes.
Broke the world.
Well, they break the world, and then they don't, you know, I think Cassius has more of a plan for what happens afterwards than Brutus does, but Cassius allows himself to be talked out of that plan in many ways because of relationship, because of how much he loves this man and is willing to subvert his own instincts, as we can all do in a relationship sometimes. We know something shouldn't be done a certain way, but we allow ourselves to be talked out of it because we love this person and we want their approval and their love and their respect. And Cassius is a very needy person in that respect when it comes to Brutus. And so it's fascinating to see how those little moments of interplay between people have these far-reaching ramifications and how many lives they affect. And I think part of what we tried to do with having the kind of chorus that we have, where we start the play with this, with all the actors coming out, and we end the play with all the actors coming out, is and they're all in this kind of costuming that is vaguely reminiscent of, I think, refugees or, you know, displaced people around the globe, is to try to have a sense of that, that these decisions that are happening between people are affecting millions of people's lives and are displacing people and are, you know, doing all these things that So yeah, that was certainly factored into our thinking about the adaptation.
Well, but speaking of that set coming down, I mean, for me, this was the first show in the new space mm-hmm. that I thought really filled the whole room,
mm-hmm.
more than Arcadia, even more than Company.
Yeah,
and I don't know why. Maybe it was its subject matter, or the fact that it's Shakespeare and it needs to be gotten up and out farther. Because we, you know, they're very nice to give us comps for the opening night, and so we always sit in the back row. And I love sitting in the back row.
Yeah.
But this really reached all the way to the back row. It really filled that great, wonderful new space.
Yeah. Well, and I think on it, just literally, we did open the space up in a way that neither Company nor Arcadia did. We really wanted, particularly once the show goes to war after the oration scene, we wanted the play to go all the way to the back wall and all the way to the sides and all the way. And so that was just to give a sense of the scale. I remember the first day we went in and saw the back wall being constructed, we were just kind of sat there for about 5 minutes looking at it with our jaws on the floor. We were like, wow, this is like just suddenly seeing the kind of scale of what the space can do.
Well, and you have to scale up the performances. Oh my God, I got to be as good as the set now.
Yeah.
I think somebody, maybe Tom as Mark Antony came in and said something about, now we can really ham it up or something. You know, it was like if it's going to be this big, we can. You know, we don't have to be small at all.
But you know what I also felt was, I felt like it was watching the Writers Theater and the Company open up. And I think part of that was the diverse the diverse actors. Yeah. I felt like for the first time, like this is like a first class theater.
This is our community.
But even bigger than that, because it is diverse, I felt like, wow, they're really owning this theater and this company. I mean, I just really felt like, whoa. Wow. This classed it all up. It's not just doing a show in Glencoe, even though they do fabulous shows.
Oh, But that's interesting you say that, because both Arcadia and Company depict a kind of rarefied group of folks. And Julius Caesar is a much more sort of down-to-earth group. Some nobles, but a lot of many folks who aren't of the nobility. And that might be what you're speaking to.
That's fascinating. I hadn't even really thought about it in those terms. I mean, I think that's certainly very much what we were trying to do. So it's lovely to hear that. But I hadn't even thought about it necessarily in those terms.
It occurred to me on the opening night, it takes a lot of balls to do a Shakespeare play in the city of the Chicago Shakespeare Theater. You know? But there's room for everything, obviously. Mm-hmm. And this was, I don't think I could imagine Chicago Shakes doing this production, which is, you know, that's why it's great.
Which is kind of nice too, right? Because it's like this big, giant production, but then in the end, it really is very intimate.
Which
is kind of the Writers' Theater.
Which is the beauty of the space, even the new space.
Well, that's the big trick of the new space, right? Is to, now that it is bigger and they have a lot more toys to play with, how do they keep the intimacy that, of course, they're known for?
Yeah.
I think that was something Michael was very interested in figuring out, how to mix those two with this production and this adaptation. And that was very much on our minds in terms of how we approached it.
And how were the audiences reacting to it? Because the Writers Theater audience, they're a lot of sleepers.
And I think a lot of them have been sleeping, probably.
Not for long with explosions, etc.
You'd be surprised what these people can sleep through sometimes. You know, I think from all accounts, they're loving it. I mean, you've
extended.
Yes.
Yeah, the run is extended.
I mean, the survey forms during previews were some of the were as positive a response as they've gotten for any show they've ever done, from what I've been told. So I think the audiences are really loving it. And one of the things we keep hearing consistently is that people who don't like Shakespeare love it. Don't usually like Shakespeare love it, which I love to hear that. That's very exciting to me. And I mean, I'm sure there are some people who don't like it. It's definitely out there. It's not a traditional Caesar in any way, and I'm sure there are people who have problems with it. But for the most part, the feedback we've gotten from audiences has been really positive and really terrific.
Well, because it is so up to the moment, you draw some parallels with the current political situation. Mm. That there are some, you know, Glencoe has a few Republicans up here who might not have taken quite so favorably to the political slant of the play. Right. I mean, it seems very fair to me, but again, I'm not as neutral as some others.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, this is the thing about Shakespeare, right? Everybody can read into him anything they want. Like, conservatives read him as being very conservative. Liberals read him as being very liberal, the greatest humanist who ever lived. You know, so it's like you can, you know, you can read almost anything you want to into him. Is, you know, ultimately, one of the questions of the play is, was killing Caesar a bad thing?
Yeah.
And I don't think we know necessarily from, by the end of the... I mean, I think we have... I think Shakespeare probably thought it wasn't a good thing, but you never really know with him. So we... And with Michael, Michael's aesthetic, he never wants to reduce Shakespeare in any way so that it's... Pardon the word.
So to speak.
Yes. He never wants it to be... He would not want it to be a, just a, like a liberal diatribe.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Like, I might be more willing to go to those places and, like, have us all wear I'm with her t-shirts at the curtain call, you know? But I'm not sure that Michael would want to do that. Michael wants, right. I think, wants people to be able to read what they want to read into it. And, you know, with gentle suggestions here and there. And I think that's a totally valid approach because that is really what Shakespeare wrote in a way is, you know.
Well, and
it's your own adventure. In a
It is because why isn't
Caesar Hillary? She's the he's the establishment, and they're disrupting it. So I think you could take it either way.
Yeah, you certainly can.
Yeah,
And Hillary, like Caesar, has a more a greater claim to being arrogant than Trump, as we we talked about earlier.
Right.
Well, and it was an incredibly perfect choice, I guess, for this moment to open. It would never have occurred to me that Julius Caesar speaks to this moment, the fall election of 2016, as perfectly as it does. But this production really did make it work.
Yeah,
well,
yeah.
I mean, God, and the whole idea that the Senate is obstructionists and they're part of the problem.
Right.
There are some great laughs, like in this production too.
Right.
It was funny.
They see this central figure who's sort of taking power away from them, and you know, the Senate's in Shakespeare's play is very much the sort of elite institution that, you know, you can make a very obvious parallel with the Republican Party right now and what's happening with this central figure who's taking away all of their power and is or is at least diminishing them in these interesting ways. And so there's definitely a lot of parallels to be made.
It seems like you don't need to play Cassius again. I mean, it seems like maybe this might have been the definitive version for you.
That's a good question. I'll never say never, but I certainly he's a very difficult role, and I think there's something almost. This is another thing I keep saying to people about Brutus and Cassius. There's something almost Chekhovian about them. I think they lift up some kind of mirror that I think makes us uncomfortable, and that can sometimes be difficult. It can I don't want to use the word unrewarding, but it can be somewhat like with Chekhov. I think sometimes audiences have a real hard time with Chekhov, and it can be somewhat, you know,
because their problems hit a little close to home.
Yeah,
and there are no easy answers or choices.
They're such deeply flawed people, and they make such. They make so many bad decisions. They make them for all the right reasons. And I guess that's what ultimately redeems them. And their love for each other, I guess, ultimately redeems them on some level, hopefully. But they're very difficult roles to play, I think. And they're very difficult to... And the tent scene, I think, is just a fiendishly difficult role. A scene to play for both actors because of the extremes of emotion that it goes to. And... So I don't know. I'd be happy to be done with it for a while because I do genuinely have a lot of love for him, and I think there are places where his story and mine intersect that are scary and you know a little painful, and I'm. And maybe that's part of why I want to run from him and not be near him for a while. But, but you know, it's. I think I'm ready. I'm ready to be done for a while. Four is good. Four times is good. As I said though, this time has been the most I've probably enjoyed playing it, and I feel like this is the time where I've gotten the closest to whatever it is he's supposed to be.
Thank you.
That's it for this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast. Send us your Shakespearean thoughts via email to feedback@reducedshakespeare.com. You can also engage with us and other fans on Facebook or Twitter. You can find easy links to all these social networks at our website, reducedshakespeare.com. You can also follow me on Twitter @AustinTichner. Thanks, as always, to Elizabethan Analog Matthew Croak, web services by Ginger Power Limited, music by John Weber and GarageBand. A random fan shout-out this week goes to Andrew Shirtle. No reason, it's just random. Special thanks to Amy Ratchford, Managing Director of the American Shakespeare Center. And finally, thanks very much to you for listening. I'm Austin Titchener, 531 1593rds of the Reduced Shakespeare Company. I'm trying to think what would be a good palate cleanser for you to do next. Like anything goes or something?
Oh, I know. I don't know. Yeah, something funny and fun would be good.
This podcast is a production of the Reduced Shakespeare Company. Reducing expectations since 1981. Go to reducedshakespeare.com for performance dates, actor bios, email newsletters, and so much less.
So much less. So much less.